Imagine surviving like a literal mob trying to tear you apart in the streets of Jerusalem.
Yeah, just absolute chaos.
Right. And you somehow make it out alive only to, you know, uncover this active assassination plot against you.
Which is terrifying.
It's crazy. And then you get thrown into a coastal prison for 3 grueling years, just completely sidelined during the absolute prime of your career.
Just stuck there.
Exactly. Stuck. Then you're finally put on a boat. You endure this terrifying shipwreck. And you basically just wash up on shore trying to survive.
Barely making it.
Right. Barely. And when you finally reach your ultimate destination, like the heart of the empire,
yeah,
you aren't greeted with a parade.
No, definitely not a parade.
You are placed under house arrest and physically chained to a heavily armed imperial guard like 24 hours a day.
It is the ultimate nightmare scenario of compounding disasters. I mean, every single time it looks like things might finally turn around, another catastrophic roadblock just drops right into the path.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring this really profound paradox today, how apparent disasters, massive roadblocks, and literal dead ends in your life can actually be, well, hidden accelerants for incredible growth.
It's a fascinating concept.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this. To do this, we're looking at a fascinating historical case study drawn from Dr. Matthew S. Harmon's analysis of the Apostle Paul's letter to the Philippians. Specifically, we're looking at chapter 1, verses 12 through 18a.
Right.
And just to be clear for everyone listening right now, our goal today isn't to, like, preach a sermon or take some theological stance.
No, not at all.
We're looking at this through the lens of pure history and Dr. Harmon's textual analysis. Because honestly, regardless of what you believe, the leadership dynamics and the psychological resilience at play here are completely wild.
They really are. And, you know, that grueling timeline you just laid out, that is the exact sequence of historical events that Paul actually endured leading up to writing this letter.
It's just exhausting to even hear.
Yeah. The year is around 60 AD. He has survived that mob back in 57 AD. He has languished in custody in Caesarea Maritima. And, well, I think the historical context of that 3-year imprisonment is vital to understand.
Yeah, break that down for us, because it wasn't just a normal jail, right?
Exactly. Caesarea Maritima wasn't just some local holding cell. It was a major Roman administrative center. So he was essentially kept in this weird bureaucratic limbo by a corrupt governor.
And the governor just wanted money. Right.
The guy was literally just hoping Paul would pay him a bribe to get out.
So it's not just physical exhaustion we're talking about. It's psychological torture. It's 3 years of your life, your mission, and your momentum just evaporating while, you know, politicians play games with you.
Exactly. So by the time he survives the subsequent shipwreck and finally reaches Rome, you would totally expect him to be thoroughly broken.
Yeah, completely burnt out.
I mean, he is the leader of a rapidly growing movement, and now he is confined to a rented apartment, which, by the way, he actually had to pay for himself.
Wait, really? The government locked him up and made him pay for it?
Yeah. The Roman government wasn't footing the bill for his confinement. He had to rely on donations from supporters just to eat and keep a roof over his head.
Wow. Okay, so the living conditions are just so strange. He's paying his own rent, but he is chained to a Roman guard, like literally physically chained.
24/7.
I was trying to picture the sheer awkwardness of this for the guards. It's like being locked in an elevator with a really relentless, high-energy salesperson.
That's a great way to put it.
Except in this case, the salesperson is a deeply passionate missionary who literally believes his message is a matter of life and death. And the guard can't leave. Paul can't leave. It's the ultimate captive audience.
It really is. And we really need to look at who these specific guards were, because that is where the strategic genius of this whole situation reveals itself.
Right. They weren't just random grunts.
No, not at all. The text points out that Paul's imprisonment became known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard. Now, for you listening, we have to stress that the Praetorian Guard wasn't just like local mall security.
Yeah, definitely not.
This was a highly trained force of about 9,000 elite soldiers. They were the personal bodyguards for the Roman emperor himself.
These are the guys who essentially run the shadow government, right? Like, they're the top of the top.
Highly, highly influential. I mean, these men were so powerful within the Roman political structure that they could, and historically actually did, literally depose and install emperors.
Just swap them out when they felt like it?
Pretty much. They were kingmakers. They had the ear of the most powerful people in the known world.
So Paul is chained to the kingmakers of the Roman Empire.
What's fascinating here is the sheer irony of the situation. You have these elite, highly trained guards chained to Paul in like 4 to 6 hour shifts.
Okay.
And what does Paul do? He just talks to them about Jesus nonstop.
Of course he does.
Right. He makes it crystal clear to them that he isn't in chains because he's some political criminal who tried to overthrow Rome. He's there strictly because of his religious convictions.
This is a huge distinction for a Roman guard.
Huge. He essentially tells them, you know, his ultimate authority isn't the Roman emperor they work for, but a higher power entirely.
According to Harmon's analysis, you can just imagine the scenes playing out in that apartment. Some of these elite guards must have been absolutely furious.
Oh, without a doubt.
They probably traded shifts with their buddies just to get away from them. Like, please, take my Tuesday afternoon shift. If I have to listen to this guy talk about a crucified man in Israel who he claims is God for one more hour, I'm going to lose my actual mind.
But, and here's the crazy part. The historical record shows that others were actually listening.
They're buying in.
Yeah. The text indicates that word began to spread throughout the barracks. They were fascinated by his resilience, his conviction. And we know this relentless networking actually worked.
How do we know that for sure?
Because later in this exact same letter, in Philippians chapter 4, Paul specifically sends greetings to his friends from believers who are in, quote, Caesar's household.
Oh, wow. Which is just brilliant.
It's incredible.
Rome thought they were quarantining a threat, right? They thought they were neutralizing a whole movement by locking up its leader and throwing away the key.
Exactly.
But in reality, Rome was funding a direct, highly secure pipeline for Paul to infiltrate the highest, most impenetrable echelons of the Roman Empire. You could not have planned a better infiltration strategy if you had millions of dollars and, like, a highly trained espionage team.
You really couldn't. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it completely reorients how you view the obstacles in your own life.
Totally.
What on the surface looked like a complete disaster, years of prison, a shipwreck, and then house arrest was actually a paradoxical mechanism. It got this message into a room that would have been entirely locked to a foreign outsider.
You know, what strikes me about this, though, is the sheer isolation of it all.
How do you mean?
Well, converting the emperor's bodyguards is an incredible localized victory.
Yeah.
But he is totally cut off from his actual community out in the city.
Right. He's physically separated.
If you are a believer living out in the city of Rome, and you see the most famous guy in your movement get arrested, put in chains, and heavily guarded by imperial assassins.
Yeah.
You probably think the movement is dead.
That would be the logical conclusion.
Right. I'd imagine the morale outside that apartment was absolutely in the gutter.
Right.
Wait, if you see the most famous guy in your movement get taken down like that, wouldn't your first instinct be to go into hiding? Why would this make anyone more bold?
That is the natural human expectation. But the source text shows that this persecution had the exact opposite effect.
Like, really?
Yes, the movement actually grew bolder. And we have to look at the psychological mechanism of why that happened. Dr. Harmon points out a vital nuance in the text. It says their confidence was in the Lord.
Okay, what does that mean in practical terms, though?
It means their confidence wasn't in Paul's earthly power or his political influence. When you see a leader stripped of all worldly power, literally chained to a wall, and yet the movement still advances.
Oh, I see.
It proves to the followers that the movement isn't reliant on just one charismatic guy. It creates anti-fragility.
Anti-fragility. That makes a lot of sense.
The believers in Rome were watching a higher power use Paul's terrible limiting circumstances to infiltrate the Praetorian Guard. Seeing that happen bolstered their faith because they realized that this higher authority trumps the Roman emperor's authority.
Because if the emperor's elite guards were being converted by a guy in chains, then the emperor wasn't really the one in control.
Exactly.
And so that realization that the absolute worst Rome can do is actually failing to stop the mission sparks this contagious boldness across the city.
It does. And Harmon connects this ancient dynamic to modern times in a very challenging way. He addresses why people today often lack boldness in sharing their beliefs or really just standing up for what they believe in general.
No, this is super relevant today.
Definitely. He identifies a modern boldness deficit, and he traces it back to a very simple psychological root. It's having a greater fear of man than a fear of God.
So basically, fearing the immediate social consequences.
Right.
We're terrified of what people will say, you know, the social rejection being canceled, the potential career impact. We fear that stuff way more than we fear any transcendent authority.
Exactly. Harmon notes that true reverence and awe for a transcendent authority naturally diminishes the fear of human opinions.
It puts things in perspective.
It really does. Furthermore, in the context of the source text, he points out that a lack of boldness often comes from a failure to grasp the heavy, eternal realities described in their theology.
The stakes, basically.
Right, the stakes. In this worldview, there is a horrific destiny, eternal punishment, and hell awaiting those outside the faith. If you truly believe that is the reality of the universe, hiding your beliefs out of social embarrassment makes absolutely no sense.
No, it would be crazy to stay quiet.
The stakes are simply too high to stay quiet just because you don't want an awkward conversation at a dinner party.
That puts an incredibly sharp point on it. It's inspiring that people got bolder and stopped caring about the social blowback.
Yeah.
But, you know, humans are complicated.
Oh, very.
And I love that this text doesn't shy away from the messy, petty reality of human nature, because not everyone who suddenly stepped up to a microphone to preach had pure motives.
No, they certainly didn't. This raises an important question about how we evaluate the motives of others, especially when we are the ones who are sidelined.
Right.
Paul actually identifies two very contrasting groups of preachers who became highly active while he was imprisoned.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
It really is. So the first group is straightforward. They are motivated by goodwill, love, and a genuine desire to see the movement advance. They love Paul and want to support the mission while he's locked up.
It's the ideal scenario.
But the second group, they are preaching out of envy, rivalry, and selfish ambition.
They look at Paul being chained to a wall and they don't see a tragedy. They see a corporate power vacuum.
Exactly. They see a chance to build their own following, elevate their own status, and maybe even cause Paul some emotional distress or trouble with his guards while he's locked up.
I try to imagine myself in that apartment, chained to a guard, getting news about this. It is so incredibly petty.
It really is.
It's exactly like being on medical leave, dealing with a major health crisis, and you find out your opportunistic coworkers are using your absence to steal your clients.
Oh, that's a perfect comparison.
They're taking credit for your projects and bad-mouthing you to the boss so they can get your promotion. That induces a visceral biological anger. How could anyone possibly be okay with that?
That is the exact tension Harmon highlights. Because Paul's reaction to this is totally counterintuitive. To understand how wild his reaction is, Harmon contrasts this letter with another letter Paul wrote earlier to the Galatians.
Okay, what happened in Galatians?
Well, in Galatians chapter 1, Paul is absolutely furious. He pronounces a literal curse on people who are preaching a different false message. He wants nothing to do with them.
So we know he has a history of not tolerating nonsense. He's not just a passive pushover.
Right. He will fight back. But here in Philippians, the situation is fundamentally different. The message these rivals are preaching is correct.
Okay.
They are teaching the actual tenets of the faith. It's just their personal motives that are completely toxic and selfish. And Paul's reaction, he rejoices.
He genuinely rejoices. He doesn't even throw a little passive aggressive shade.
He rejoices. He essentially says, you know, whether in pretense or in truth, the message is getting out there.
Wow.
As long as the truth of the mission is advancing, he doesn't care about his own ego or his personal ministry metrics. Harmon emphasizes that this teaches a really powerful leadership lesson.
Which is?
It is entirely okay to acknowledge that people have sketchy, ungodly, or selfish motives. You don't have to pretend they are great people. You don't have to invite them to dinner. But you can still rejoice that the overarching mission is moving forward, even if it's being carried by flawed, opportunistic messengers.
That requires an ego death that is phenomenally hard to achieve.
Oh, absolutely.
You have to care more about the big picture than you care about getting the credit or getting justice for being slighted.
Yeah.
So if the mission is advancing despite these toxic motives internally, what happens when it hits an actual brick wall of external opposition?
Yes, the next big hurdle.
How does Harmon say we should practically engage with people who actively push back against the mission?
Harmon dives into Paul's focus on defending the gospel. And this brings up a crucial psychological and philosophical concept dealing with what are called defeater beliefs.
Defeater beliefs. I love that term. How does that cognitive filter actually work?
A defeater belief is a deeply held idea, assumption, or cultural narrative that makes it essentially impossible for someone to accept a new truth.
So it's a roadblock in their mind.
Exactly. It acts like a firewall in the brain. For example, if someone firmly believes that all historical documents are inherently fabricated by whoever won a war, they have a defeater belief that prevents them from trusting any ancient historical text you present to them.
Because they've already decided it's fake.
Right. You could show them the most perfectly preserved artifact, and their brain will just reject it because their foundational assumption defeats the evidence before it can even be processed.
Oh, I see.
Part of defending any truth is patiently identifying and removing these objections, explaining how their underlying belief doesn't actually align with reality.
But Harmon gives a massive caveat here, right? Because anyone who has spent 5 minutes arguing on the internet knows that you can't just debate someone into changing their entire worldview.
Exactly. You will rarely, if ever, simply argue someone into a completely new belief system. Harmon shares a very powerful, practical tool from his years doing full-time campus ministry at a large secular university.
Okay, what's the tool?
He found that when you face a wall of endless intellectual objections from someone, those objections are very often just smokescreens.
It's like a magician's misdirection.
Yes.
The magician wants you to look at the flashy hand waving the wand so you don't notice what the other hand is doing in their pocket.
That's a perfect analogy.
The intellectual debate is the flashy wand. It keeps you distracted, spinning your wheels, so you don't look at the real issue.
Exactly. The person will throw up questions about carbon dating, historical footnotes, or obscure philosophical dilemmas, and the moment you answer one, they magically have three more.
It never ends.
It never ends. Harmon used a specific clarifying question to cut right through that misdirection, and it is a masterclass in getting to the root of an issue.
Walk us through this clarifying question, because this is something anyone can use in their daily life.
When you realize you are stuck in an endless loop of debate, you pause the conversation, look them in the eye, and ask, if I could hypothetically answer all of your intellectual questions perfectly right now, would you then commit your life to this?
Wow. You just completely put the cards on the table and bypass the intellect entirely.
Exactly. And Harmon notes that very often the honest answer to that question is, no, I still wouldn't.
Which is crazy to admit.
It is. But that moment is incredibly revealing for both people. Because if the answer is no, then the intellectual debate was never the real issue.
Right.
The intellectual debate was a smokescreen to delay making a decision. The real bottleneck is almost always a lifestyle issue.
They know that if they accept the truth of what you are saying, they will have to change how they live their life.
Yes.
They might have to give up a habit they love, change their social circle, or admit they've been wrong for decades.
Uh-huh.
And they simply don't want to.
Precisely. The fear of change is the actual wall. The clarifying question saves everyone a massive amount of time and frustration. It allows you to stop arguing about historical footnotes and start talking about the actual bottleneck.
Which is what?
Which is asking, what is really holding you back from making a change in your life?
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? We've covered Roman political history, the psychology of captive audiences, dealing with toxic coworkers, and cutting through intellectual smokescreens.
It's a lot of ground.
It is. How do we pull all these massive historical and practical threads together?
Harmon synthesizes this entire deep dive into a very practical fourfold framework for application. It's designed to help you process your own roadblocks. It's broken down into think, believe, desire, and do.
Okay, let's explore how these build on each other. Start with think.
First, think. You need to fundamentally shift your understanding of reality. Recognize that a higher power has much larger purposes for your life than simply ensuring your day-to-day comfort.
Which is hard to hear.
It is. Comfort is not the primary goal of the universe, and assuming it is will only lead to constant disappointment.
That's a tough pill to swallow, but it creates deep resilience. Then we move to believe.
Right. Believe is where you take that thought and actually apply it. You have to actively trust that any and all circumstances, even the deeply painful, restrictive, and confusing ones, can be utilized for an unexpected greater good.
So it's not just blind optimism.
No, not at all. This doesn't mean the hard things aren't hard. It doesn't diminish the grief of a loss or the frustration of a dead end. But it means the pain isn't pointless. It is part of a larger architecture.
Okay, think and believe make logical sense. But let me challenge this third one, desire.
Go for it.
Harmon says we need to cultivate a deep longing to see truth and the overarching mission advance over our own comfort. But how do you actually train yourself to desire a mission over your own physical comfort? That goes entirely against basic human survival instincts.
It does go against basic instincts, which is exactly why it requires a deliberate shift in the horizon of your gratification.
What does that mean?
Cultivating this desire means you stop looking at the next 5 days and start looking at the next 5 generations or even eternity.
Yeah.
You have to want the big picture to succeed more than you want an easy life.
So it's a long game.
The longest game. It's an acquired taste, built by constantly reminding yourself of the eternal stakes we talked about earlier.
Which naturally leads to the final step.
Yeah.
Do.
Yes. The action step is highly specific. Identify just one person in your life right now. Begin praying for an open door to have a meaningful conversation with them about these deeper truths.
Just one person.
Just one. But Harmon adds a vital warning here from his own life. Make sure you are actually ready when that door opens.
Oh, that's good.
Do the work to prepare yourself. Don't ask for the opportunity and then be too scared or too worried about your social standing to step through it when it finally presents itself.
That is such a practical, challenging roadmap. We started this deep dive talking about life's terrible detours, the shipwrecks, the prisons, the sheer unfairness of having your momentum stopped cold.
Yeah, the worst case scenarios.
Right. And we just spent this time looking at how Paul's literal iron chains were actually the exact highly specialized keys used to unlock the highest, most impenetrable levels of the Roman elite.
It completely flips the narrative.
It really does. It makes you wonder about your own life. Look at the biggest roadblock, the most frustrating dead end, or the tightest confinement you are dealing with right now.
Right.
What if it isn't a detour at all? What if that exact limitation, that thing you are begging to be freed from, is actually the custom-built vehicle required to get you into a room you are always meant to influence? What if the very thing restricting you right now is actually the key to a door you could never have opened any other way?